You know, Einstein completely blew our minds when he proved that time is relative.
Oh, absolutely. The whole idea that it's an actual fabric.
Right, a fabric that can, like, bend and stretch based on speed and gravity. I mean, it was a massive paradigm shift that changed the world.
Yeah, it completely rewrote physics.
But as we start today's deep dive, I really want you to consider a pretty staggering question. What if we spent the last century staring at that fabric, but we've been missing a fundamental structural component of the universe?
Right. What if Einstein's model is, you know, actually just a tiny fraction of the whole picture?
Exactly. And that's exactly what we're looking at today.
It's a really profound thing to think about because we are just so accustomed to the concept of space-time, you know, the idea that time and space form this single universal stage that we all just walk across.
We just take it as a given.
We do. But the source material we are exploring today suggests that traditional space-time is essentially just a localized subset. It's like a very special, limited case of a much larger, much more complex architecture.
And that brings us to the core mission of this deep dive. Today, we're doing something special. We are presenting a detailed, foundational exploration of a groundbreaking framework called the Hayes theory.
Right, that's spelled Hayyiz.
Yeah, and it was first formulated back in 2010 by engineer Muhel Ali Al-Faqih. We've actually custom-tailored this discussion to introduce you, the listener, to an entirely new way of perceiving reality.
Which is why this specific audio presentation is designed to be featured on the theory's official website at ht.mohel.com.
Exactly. It shifts our entire cosmological understanding away from a single space-time, and it replaces it with this concept of haze.
So to really grasp this, I mean, we first need to define what Hayes actually is. In this framework, the universe isn't just a two-part system of time and space.
Right, it's bigger than that.
Yeah, it's a tripartite structure, a triple framework. You have time, which acts as the temporal vessel and answers the questions, you know, when and how long. Then you have space, the dimensional vessel answering where. And crucially, you have the event, the actual content answering what changed.
Okay, I want to give you a visual anchor for this right out of the gate because I think it's brilliant. The theory uses a very specific analogy. Imagine that space is a solid wooden table,
Right.
and time is a glass cup sitting on that table. In the traditional space-time model, that's all we study, the cup and the table. But Hayes' theory says, wait, what about the water inside the cup?
Yes. The water represents the event. And by the way, that analogy is exactly why the theory's official logo is a dynamic, splashing blue drop of water.
Oh, I love that. It perfectly illustrates the independence of the
It
components.
really does.
Yeah.
Because the event takes the shape of the cup and it rests on the table, but it has entirely distinct properties from the glass and the wood. If you want to understand reality, you cannot just look at the container. You have to understand the water.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this is where my brain immediately tripped up when I was reading the sources. I was thinking, wait, how can an event be independent?
It's a tough hurdle at first.
Yeah, I mean, isn't an event just something that happens inside time and space? Like, a car crash needs a physical road to happen on,
Right.
right? And a specific time of day to occur. Why does the event need to be its own separated structural component?
It's a completely natural reaction. I mean, our brains are hardwired to view time and space as the permanent stage and the event as just the actors reading their lines.
Exactly.
But to prove why the event cannot just be permanently glued to time and space, the author uses a fascinating set of data points. And it's important to contextualize this for you, the listener. The theory draws extensively from ancient Islamic traditions and Quranic narratives.
Right, but it doesn't just use them as spiritual metaphors, does it?
No, not at all. The author treats these narratives as literal physical case studies of physics in action.
Which brings us to the first major case study in the text, the historical account of the village man. He's often identified in tradition as Uzair.
Yes. The village man is a perfect illustration of what the theory calls Hayes allocation. That's where multiple distinct states of reality exist in the exact same physical spot.
Okay, so how does the story break that down?
Well, according to the account, a man is put into a state of death or suspended animation for exactly 100 years in a specific physical location. When he is brought back to life, he looks around.
Right, and the space is the same.
Exactly. The space the GPS coordinates, if you will, is exactly the same. The chronological time that has passed in the outside world is 100 years. He looks at his donkey, and it has completely decomposed. It's just dust and bones.
So the donkey experienced the full 100 years.
Yes, the donkey experienced the biological event of those 100 years. But then he looks at his food and drink, which were sitting right next to the donkey.
And the food is perfectly fresh.
Yeah.
It hasn't rotted at all.
Exactly. Now, let's apply standard physics to this. If time were permanently and universally glued to the space and the event, that food would have decayed right alongside the donkey.
Because it's in the exact same spot.
Yes. The physical location was identical. The temporal duration passing overhead was identical. But the biological event of decay did not occur for the food.
Okay, so going back to our analogy, it's like we have two cups of water on the same table. In one cup, the water is boiling furiously. That's the donkey decaying.
Right.
But in the second cup, sitting right next to it, the water is frozen solid.
Mm-hmm.
That's the food. The table hasn't changed. The cups haven't moved. But the behavior of the water inside is entirely independent.
That is precisely it. The man was paused in one haze state. The donkey decayed in a second state. The village outside flourished in a third. And the food was preserved in a fourth.
Wow.
The event is not dictated by the space or the time. It is independent.
That is such a wild concept to wrap your head around.
Yeah.
But there's a second case study that really drives the point home, and it has to do with velocity.
Ah, yes. The throne of Bilqis.
Right, the Queen of Sheba. Uh-huh. Moving this massive, physical, jewel-encrusted throne from Yemen to Jerusalem is a single event, just one action. But according to the narrative, this one single event generated three completely different time estimates based on who was interacting with it.
And the breakdown of those estimates is where the physics of Heias really starts to show its face. So King Solomon asks for the throne to be brought to him. Historically, moving an army or a caravan across that distance would take about 10 days.
Which is the standard human time frame.
Right, the standard physical human space-time estimate. Then, a powerful entity, an Ifrit from the Jinn, offers to do it before Solomon stands from his seat. For the sake of argument, let's call that a 5-hour window.
Okay.
Finally, a man who is described as having knowledge of the book says he can do it before Solomon can even blink his eye. So, less than a second.
Three totally different times for the exact same physical event. 10 days, 5 hours, and a fraction of a second. So my initial thought reading this was, okay, the guy with the knowledge just accelerated the throne to near light speed. Like, he just applied way more force.
No, and that is exactly the trap standard physics falls into. He didn't change the speed at all. He didn't alter the velocity of the mass.
Wait, really? Then how did he move it?
What he changed was the corridor it traveled through. He altered the haze state. Think of it like a shortcut through the very fabric of reality. The event of moving the throne was decoupled from the physical time it usually takes.
So wait, if different entities, like a normal human, a djinn, or someone with special knowledge, can experience the exact same physical space or the same event in completely different ways, how do we mathematically make sense of that?
There actually is a way.
Is there an actual mathematical formula to measure this? Because if everyone is in their own reality bubble, shouldn't we just be bumping into invisible walls all day?
This is where engineer Muhlhell introduces the specific mechanics of cognitive relativity. He provides a mathematical formula to define what an observer actually experiences.
Oh, I love when things get quantifiable. Walk me through that.
The formula is T perceived equals T physical multiplied by F of P.
Okay, let's break that down. What is F of P?
So T perceived is the time as you, the observer, actually feel and experience it. T physical is the standard measurable chronological time ticking on a wall clock.
Makes sense.
But the absolute key to this theory is F of P. That stands for the cognitive processing power of the observer.
So my perceived time isn't a constant. It is directly multiplied by my brain's ability to process information.
Yes. But here is the critical detail. The sources note that this relationship is logarithmic, not linear.
Wait, why does that distinction matter?
Well, if it were a linear relationship, doubling your brain power would just make things feel twice as slow. Simple math. But a logarithmic relationship means that as your cognitive processing power scales up massively, say, into advanced entity states or supernatural states, the perceived time compresses or expands exponentially.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you could experience 1,000 years of subjective, conscious events in what a physical wall clock measures as a fraction of a millisecond.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because we actually feel a micro version of this in real life, don't we?
We do, yeah.
Think about being in a minor car accident. In those 3 seconds before the bumper hits, time feels like it stretches into minutes. everything slows down.
Exactly.
According to this formula, that's because your F of P, your cognitive processing function, is suddenly working in absolute overdrive. It's logging every detail to keep you alive. The physical clock didn't change, but your haze expanded.
That is a perfect real-world application of the math. But we still need to answer your earlier question.
Right, about bumping into invisible walls.
Yeah. If we all have our own independent haze, our own customized cognitive time bubbles, how do we ever share a moment? How do I hand you a cup of coffee without our realities glitching?
Right. How are we sitting in this room having a conversation right now if our processing rates are even slightly different?
The theory accounts for this through the concept of relative equilibrium. It states that entities existing in the same general physical space naturally reach a state of balance that allows for structural interaction.
So we sort of sync up.
Exactly. We subconsciously synchronize our haze states just enough to share a functional reality. And the primary tool we use to maintain that synchronization is memory.
Memory. Wait, how does memory act as a physical tool?
Memory acts as the haze bridge. It is what connects these different states together across time and space. When you remember meeting someone yesterday, you are literally maintaining a structural bridge to that past haze state.
That is wild.
And conversely, forgetting entirely severs that bridge. It disconnects you from that specific coordinate in reality.
Wow. Okay, so if time is completely relative to our cognitive capacity, and memory is the physical bridge holding our shared reality together, we have to tackle what I think is the most radical claim in the entire deep dive.
I think I know where you're going with this.
If time and space aren't the primary immovable drivers of the universe, what is?
The theory proposes a complete inversion of our standard logic. The event actually creates the time and space, not the other way around.
Okay, my brain just short-circuited. Say that again.
We usually think that a room has to exist and a time has to arrive before an event can happen inside them, right?
Right, obviously.
Haye's theory flips that. The event generates the coordinates. To illustrate this, the source material uses the profound case study of the meeting between the prophet Moses and Al-Qudr.
Ah, yes. So in this historical narrative, Moses is traveling to find Al-Qudr to learn from him. But what's so strange about this story is how the meeting is scheduled.
It wasn't on a calendar.
No. Usually you say, let's meet Tuesday at noon by the Big Rock. But it wasn't scheduled for a specific chronological time or a specific GPS coordinate. The appointment was tied entirely to an event.
Specifically losing their food.
Right. Moses and his companion were carrying a dead fish for food. Moses was told he would find Al-Qudr exactly at the place and moment where the dead fish miraculously came back to life and escaped into the sea.
What's fascinating here is if we look at that through the lens of Haye's theory, the implications are stunning. The physical location and the chronological time of the meeting literally did not exist as coordinates until the event occurred.
So the event, the fish escaping, generated the space-time coordinates.
Yes. Going back to your earlier analogy, the water actually created the cup and the table.
That is mind-blowing. The event is the anchor.
It is. If time was a built-in, unchangeable prerequisite, the event could never precede the time. But here, the event gave birth to the when and the where.
Unbelievable.
And the dynamic between Moses and Al-Qudr goes even deeper. When they finally meet, Al-Qudr immediately tells Moses, you will not be able to have patience with me.
Yeah, and I always read that as just like a personality clash.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a really difficult teacher, my methods are harsh, you won't be able to handle it.
Most people do, but through the lens of this theory, it wasn't a personality crash at all. It was a statement of structural physics.
Were you really?
Yeah, it was a fundamental incompatibility between their two haze states. Al-Qudr was operating in a haze where the future outcomes of events were visible in his present. He could see a ship being confiscated in the future or a wall collapsing down the line.
And Moses wasn't.
Exactly. Moses was operating in a standard linear human haze. They were standing in the exact same physical space, breathing the same air, but they were not in the same reality.
Because their processing was different.
Right. Moses literally could not process the events because his cognitive function, his F of P, was not calibrated to Al-Qudr's reality bubble.
Okay, so understanding that these reality bubbles can overlap while remaining totally separate completely changes how we view what humans have historically called magic or miracles.
It shifts them from magic to actual physics.
Right. But if these states are separate, how do you cross from one to another?
The theory introduces the concept of SBOB, which translates to pathways or corridors. There are pathways between different Hayes states, but they require specific empowerment to traverse.
We can actually look at two historical figures who interacted with these corridors to see how that works, Pharaoh and Dulcarnain.
The contrast here is perfectly illustrative.
It is fascinating. So Pharaoh, according to the texts, explicitly wanted to reach the ASBAB, the pathways of the heavens. He wanted to access a higher Hayes. But how did he try to do it?
By building a tower?
Yeah, he ordered his minister to build a massive physical tower of mud and baked brick. He tried to use purely material effort to cross a non-physical barrier. And of course, he failed completely.
Because you simply cannot build a physical staircase to climb out of your cognitive reality. It's fundamentally impossible.
Right.
Contrast that with Dulcarnain. The texts explicitly state he was granted the ASBAB. He didn't build a tower. He was given divine empowerment to traverse these corridors.
So it requires a non-material key.
Exactly. Because of this non-material empowerment, he was able to travel to regions where he experienced entirely different physical laws. He observed different suns, interacted with different peoples, and most notably, he constructed a barrier.
And this barrier isn't just a wall made of iron and copper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though physical materials were used, the theory emphasizes something far more complex.
Yes. The physical materials were just an anchor for a Hayes barrier. This actually explains the historical and theological mystery of Gog and Magog.
Oh, because people always ask, how could entire civilizations be hidden on Earth today with satellites scanning everything?
Exactly. The reason we cannot see them and they cannot see us, even though we share the exact same planet, is because they are sequestered behind a Hayes barrier.
Let me try to put an analogy to this because it's pretty dense.
Yeah.
Imagine two radio stations broadcasting in the exact same room. One is on 97.1 FM and the other is on 101.3 FM.
That's a great way to picture it.
Both signals are physically filling the room. They don't crash into each other.
Yeah.
But if your radio receiver, your cognitive processing function is only built to tune into 97.1, you will swear up and down that the other music doesn't exist.
Right.
Gog and Magog are just on a different frequency in the same room.
That is an excellent visualization. They exist in our physical space, but in a completely separate, inaccessible reality bubble.
But wait. If there are these invisible walls, do things ever leak through? Which brings us to the concept of permeability. The theory uses the story of the people of the cave to demonstrate this.
Yeah, the sleepers.
Yeah, these were youths who fled persecution and hid in a cave where they ended up sleeping for over 300 years.
The people of the cave is a brilliant case study of how different rules apply to different components of Hayes and how permeability works. When they went to sleep, their biological time sensing center was paused.
So going back to our water analogy, the water in their cup froze perfectly solid.
Exactly. Their physical bodies did not age 300 years. However, their logical memory was perfectly preserved. And remember, memory is the bridge.
And the craziest detail is the material items. When they woke up, thinking they had only slept a day, they sent one of their friends to the city to buy food.
Mm-hmm, with their old coins.
Right, they handed him the silver coins they had in their pockets. They were using the exact same old coins from 3 centuries prior. Their physical tools were preserved within their paused bubble.
But, and this is the absolute key to permeability, the texts explicitly note that as the sun rose and set outside the cave, its light and shadows physically shifted away from their bodies, purposefully avoiding them.
So even though they were locked in a paused bubble, the outside universe was still somewhat interacting with them.
Yes. The shifting of the sun proves that some physical effects, like sunlight or shadows, can permeate or leak through different Hayes barriers.
That is so cool.
The youths were isolated in a paused temporal state, yet the physical universe outside was commanded to slightly interact with their space to protect them from decay. It's a flawless example of reality states intercepting, separating, and leaking into one another.
So we've talked about all these incredible phenomena. Paused time, biological decay decoupled from space, invisible barriers, traversing corridors. It begs the question, how exactly does an entity move from one Hayes to another?
Is it just random?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Is there a specific system for how we jump between realities?
It is highly systematic. The theory outlines a strict hierarchy of transfer. It starts at the most basic level, which is natural daily transfer. This is sleep.
Sleep is a transfer.
Every single living entity experiences a minor shift in their Hayes when they dream. Your physical body stays in bed, but your cognitive processing function shifts.
Right. You can live out a massive, complex, adventure spanning days in what is physically just a 5-minute REM cycle.
Exactly. Then you have compulsory transfer, which is death. This moves the entity into what Islamic theology calls the barzakh.
Like a waiting room.
Yeah, you can think of the barzakh as the ultimate waiting room, a barrier state between the physical world and the afterlife. It is an entirely distinct haze with its own rules of time and perception.
Okay, so sleep and death apply to everyone. What's next in the hierarchy?
Next is transfer based on entity capabilities. This refers to entities like the jinn, who naturally operate in a different frequency and can interact with ours, like the ifrit, who offered to move the throne in 5 hours.
Got it. And above that.
And above that is special knowledge.
Ah, that would be the man with the knowledge of the book who moved the throne in a fraction of a second.
Precisely. He wasn't relying on physical strength or natural entity capability. He utilized specialized, granted knowledge to manipulate the corridor. And finally, at the absolute peak of the hierarchy, you have direct divine empowerment.
And the presentation highlights the ultimate model for this, the Isra and Miraj. The night journey and ascension of the Prophet Muhammad.
Yes. The theory posits this as the absolute completion and ultimate proof of the entire Hayy's framework.
Because it combines everything.
It is the perfect model because it seamlessly combines every single aspect of the theory into one singular event. First, you have a massive spatial transfer traveling from Mecca to Jerusalem in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have an ultimate dimensional transfer ascending through the seven heavens. These are realms with entirely different physical rules, populated by different entities, operating on completely different temporal realities.
And the detail that always stands out to me, the return.
Yeah.
He made this immense multi-dimensional journey spanning heavens and interacting with past prophets. And when he returned to his physical starting point on Earth, his bed was still warm.
If you try to analyze that using standard space-time, it completely breaks down. I mean, it defies physics.
Totally.
But under Hayy's theory, it makes perfect logical sense. The journey occurred through divinely empowered asbab, those pathways. The cognitive processing function, the F of P, and the temporal reality of the traveler were fundamentally elevated by the creator.
Wow.
It proves that ultimate mastery over Hayy's is intrinsically linked to divine proximity.
So as we zoom out, what does this all mean? We've gone from Einstein to the throne of Bilqis to invisible radio station barriers to the seven heavens. For the listener tuning in right now, how do we synthesize all of this?
Well, engineer Mohl's theory leaves us with 5 grand conclusions. First, there was no time or space before creation. God created and completely encompasses all Hayy's. Time and space are not eternal, unbreakable constraints. They're simply created tools.
Okay. And second, every observer's perspective, yours, mine, a sleeping youth in a cave, a jinn, is totally relative and partial. The only absolute complete perspective of reality belongs to the creator.
Exactly. Third, this framework finally provides a cohesive logical structure for phenomena that have historically baffled the human mind. Miracles, the supernatural, time dilation, and dreams, they aren't breaks in reality.
They aren't just magic.
No, they are simply the physics of a broader reality. They're the physics of Hayy's.
Fourth, the relationship between the observer and the observed is entirely relative across all dimensions.
And fifth, as we just discussed, the transfer between these different reality bubbles is arranged in a strict hierarchy, deeply tied to divine knowledge and empowerment.
Which ultimately completely reframes how we view our own existence. We are not just moving through a static ticking clock on a wooden stage.
No, we are constantly generating our reality through events, cognitive processing, and memory.
It is just a staggering amount of information to process. And if your mind is spinning right now, remember, this deep dive is just the audio introduction.
There is so much more to see.
To truly grasp this, to explore the full visual presentation, and to dive much deeper into the actual mathematical equations, like how that cognitive processing logarithm works in detail, you absolutely have to visit the official website at ht.molel.com.
I highly recommend viewing the visual aids there. They take these massive abstract concepts and ground them into clear structural geometry.
Yeah, you will see that splashing water logo we talked about, and the diagrams there map out these complex corridors in a way that just makes everything click.
It's brilliantly laid out.
As we wrap up this exploration into the Hayy's theory, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We started by talking about Einstein, showing us reality isn't what it seems. But Hayy's theory takes that to a profoundly personal level.
It really does.
Think about Principle 8 of the theory, which states, unperceived existence does not mean non-existence. Just because you can't see the water doesn't mean the cup is empty.
Which forces us to ask a very uncomfortable but thrilling question.
It does. If your entire perception of reality right now, the speed the clock is ticking on your wall, the solid dimensions of the room you're sitting in is just a limited, customized bubble dictated entirely by your personal cognitive processing power. Ask yourself what entirely different realities, what ancient entities, or what massive events are unfolding in the exact same physical space as you right now, perfectly hidden behind a haze barrier you simply haven't been tuned in to hear.